Hello.
Good morning. We have a couple of announcements before I begin. Go ahead, use the microphone.
Okay, so who's interested in an A in this class? All right, just kidding, but we have $500 to give away and iPods and a lot of other cool prizes.
We're from the Resource Efficiency Program, and we're promoting a cartoon competition on energy reduction.
So basically, if you can't draw, you can submit like a clip art of the environment or anything you want and just write a little caption. And everyone votes, and the winner gets $500, and then everyone else gets like iPods and all these cool prizes. There's
And your work goes on a tour of all the different dining halls. So it's really cool. You get fame and fortune if you win.
And historically, not a lot of people enter, so your chances are good. So if you have some free time, not during this class, just draw a cartoon.
Sweet. And here are the opportunities.
Wait.
I lied. Here's someone from the Vagina Monologues.
Hi, I'm not the opportunities. I'm sorry. My name is Jenna. Some of you may know that I love vaginas and orgasms, but for those of you who don't know, the Vagina Monologues are this weekend, tonight, Friday, Saturday, 8, it all goes to charities for women and violence. And this is the first time a trans piece has ever been performed at Harvard. So it's honoring that not all women are born with vaginas. So you should definitely come out. And if not, enjoy your sexuality.
Good morning, Positive Psych. We are the Harvard Opportunes, and we're Harvard's oldest co-ed a cappella group. We have a concert coming up tomorrow night. That's Friday. It's with the Din and Tonics, and it's hosted by Professor Pinker. Tickets are $8, and they're available at the box office, at the door, or from any of us. It's going to be a great show, and we hope to see some of you there. Thanks a lot.
Okay. So I want to continue a discussion that we started in class last time. So remember last time we talked about what is it about Harvard, the environment? Now the question that Rachel Pollack brought up, what is it about the environment here that is making things difficult for us? Is it self-selection? Is it the environment itself? Now, that was the first part of the question that I'd like to address with you. The second part of the question that I want to address right now is, so what do we do about it? All right, so it's a stressful environment. Priming is an important issue. You know, there's a lot of perfectionism here, a lot of competition. We're constantly primed by, you know, striving for more and more. We're no longer the only best people. You know, everyone here is the best. So what do we do about it? What advice do you have for yourself or other Harvard students? Things that you have done, that you have tried, or things that you haven't tried and you think may work to make our experience here more positive? Notwithstanding the ups and downs, but overall a more positive experience here. What would you suggest? What do you think may work or what has worked? Also, think about your response papers that you wrote for last week about the great experiences that you had. What can you learn from these experiences and apply to your Harvard experience? Any Any volunteers? Any suggestions?
Go party.
Go party. Yeah. Party where?
Anywhere.
Anywhere, okay. Yeah, but no, social life, more parties. But why do you think we don't party as much as what I don't want to say any college name here, but as much as Yale, for example. Why don't we party more here? Seriously. Or maybe we do. Why didn't I party more as an undergrad? Let's put it this way. What's stopping us from doing it if we think it will make us happier? Too self-absorbed in my work, yes, that's true, I was. What else? What else?
They care
too much about my academic success, that's true. God, you really know me, it's amazing. Yeah, maybe I'm giving too much information in this class, yeah.
I feel like I'm always
running on borrowed time. We don't have time here, right? No, even at best, all we have is, and that's just Harvard student, 25 hours a day, right? We can't have any more than that. And we just not enough to do the readings, to study extracurriculars, to the Gazoo recruiting. I mean, there are so many things going on here. You know, we're going to devote a whole week to just this idea of how do we make better use of our time? Because we only have a finite amount. So can we find more time for partying or for other things? Great point. What else? What other suggestions do you have? Right. Yeah, so the suggestion is instead of looking outside, to the outside as a point of reference, comparison, let's look more inside ourselves, relative to ourselves. How can I improve? Remember I talked about at the beginning, the question is not am I happy or not, because how do you measure it? Do you measure it compared to the person next to you, compared to the average Harvard student, average Yale student? I mean, how do you measure it? Well, let's ask how can I be happier, not compared to anyone else. Also, how can I succeed, not compared to other people. Now, having said that, we naturally compare. I haven't met anyone. Again, except, I always use this example, but except maybe for the Dalai Lama who has reached this stage where he is so self-contained that he doesn't compare himself to others. But most people and everyone I know, we compare ourselves to others. And in the Permission to Be Human lecture, I talk about envy. Why do we envy others? Because they say, why have they got so much and I don't have as much? So it's inevitable that we compare. However, that doesn't mean that we can't also shift the focus more toward inside and say, so how can I improve myself? As opposed to having an external measure of evaluation, the other students in the section, the other students here, how have I improved since I came here? What can I do to improve? Easier said than done, and we're going to spend a lot of time when we talk about self-esteem. We're going to spend a lot of time talking about this particular issue, weakening the comparison inclination and strengthening the self-improvement inclination. Very good point. What else?
I think you should be able to. I think there's a feeling here that party time and socializing can't be scheduled into your schedule. Mm-hmm. I think if you can really give it a brand and set aside time to do it, you're much more likely to do it and feel happy.
Yeah. So the point is that schedule party time. Put it on your schedule. Put your schedule time with my roommates. Put on your schedule. Time to just veg out. Now, this sounds a little bit weird, doesn't it? You know what one of the biggest breakthroughs for me was in my my marriage life? Too much info? No. because, you know, especially after my son was born, and I teach a lot, I travel a lot, and my wife and I would always say, well, you know, we need to schedule time, but it has to be spontaneous.
know, that suddenly in the, you know, the throes of passion, and suddenly we are together and we spent time. We were too much information. So until we read an article in one of the scientific magazines, I don't know if it was Cosmo or Vogue, one of the magazines, I think it was probably Self, actually, I like that magazine. And they said that you should schedule time together, that there is absolute, I mean, there's everything right with it, because we are always chasing ourselves, we never have time. Put time aside and say, okay, Friday afternoon is family time. You know, Wednesday afternoon is family time. You know, one night a week is, you know, film and daytime. Schedule it. That made a huge difference for me, because if we didn't schedule and we just said, well, let's be spontaneous, just didn't work out. Big thing, yeah, and we're going to talk about that also when we talk about time as one of the techniques that we can use. Schedule it. I mean, we do it for work, for the most important things that we want to get done. Why not do it in relationships? Yeah, what else? Other suggestions, yes. Yeah, so ignore what everyone else is doing. This is compared, you know, stop comparing. Ask yourself what, and you're going to have a response paper on this. What do I really, really, really want to do? Independent of what my classmates are doing, independent of what society is telling me I should do. And think about it. What do I really, really want to do? And then go and pursue it. Not always easy, because we can't ignore other people. We're, again, part of being human. But once we ask ourselves these questions, you know, we can identify things about ourselves and then pursue them. We're going to talk about that a lot. Good boy. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, this is an important point actually discussed by Professor Brian Little, who, for those of you who are going to be here next year, you should take his class in personality psychology. And he talks about the fact that very often we get our self-esteem to depend on one thing: academic, athletics, relationship, or whatever. Instead, don't spread yourself thin, and you know, do go into depth, but have more than one thing that you do. And this will, you'll be able to withstand, you'll be more resilient when one of the three things that you do doesn't go well. It's always possible to find a few things in life that are really, really important for us. So, in other words, not all the eggs in one basket. Other suggestions? Up there, anything? Yes. Yeah. Yeah, dance and yoga. And we're going to talk about research, actually, that talks about the importance of dance. One of my students, Ebony, in my sophomore tutorial, did her research on dance therapy. A lot of interesting stuff happening there. Those of you who do ballroom dancing or just dancing know how it makes you feel. I mean, for me, I did a lot of ballroom dancing. And whenever anyone saw me, they would ask, especially people who knew me well, said, you know, why do you have this stupid smile on your face all the time? Can't help it, you know, it just brings it out. Makes a big difference. And we have lost touch with our body. We've lost touch with touch, as we'll discuss. And dancing brings, you know, a lot of physiological reactions that translate themselves into more happiness. And yoga, of course, we'll talk about a lot. Okay, so we have some suggestions. We're going to continue this, and we're going to talk about these things in lectures. We're going to talk about these things in sections. Not all suggestions may be applicable to you. You know, some people emailed me about last week's lecture and said, you know, this is just what I needed to hear. This was great. And other people said, you know, had issues with it. And that's fine. Not everything is going to appeal to you. But take the things that do. This class is about you. It's not about anyone else. I've had many requests. People wanted to know more about my relationship with Rina, And you know, I spoke so highly of her, and so I decided to share a picture with you. It's Rina and me together in my dreams. Okay. All right. So, let's move on. I look good in that picture, don't I? How do we become optimists? Realistic optimists. Now, I was thinking on my way here to class this morning that the real name for this class, or the true name that will capture what this class is about, is not actually positive psychology. Yeah, positive psychology is most of the literature that I rely on. It's a big movement. But if I had to find a name that really captures what I think this class is about, it would be reality psychology, as opposed to positive psychology. It wouldn't be detached optimism that is often associated with the positive. It would be reality. So how do we become realistic optimists? I talked about three approaches. The first one is through action, through behavior. The second one is by using our imagination. And the third one is through cognitive therapy. And I'm going to go over each of the three. Let me begin with the behavioral change, with the action part. Drawing on work by Albert Bandura, very important psychologist. I mentioned him last time, from Stanford, and has done work basically given the scientific name for positive thinking in the form of self-efficacy. Remember the quotes that I used two times ago. And he says that in order to increase our self-efficacy, our belief in ourselves, one way to do it is by self-persuasion. You know, for some people it could be standing in front of the mirror and saying it. You know, I don't find that helpful. But believe me, I've tried every single technique out there. I've read every self-help book that I could get my hand up. Personally, it doesn't help. Some people swear by it. You know, every morning they get up, they look in the mirror and say, "Hi, beautiful. Well, this is going to be a great day today." And for some people, it works. And Bandura says, yes, self-persuasion is important. However, a more effective way, and he has shown this through a lot of research, a more effective way for raising our belief in ourselves, our sense of optimism, our self-efficacy, is through hard work and coping. Now, let me clarify here, because some people were unclear about what I meant by coping. Coping is the word that I take from the literature specifically. You don't need to know that yet, because we'll talk about it when we talk about self-esteem. Work by Bednar and Pedersen, one social worker, one psychologist, who talk about the word coping. And they don't mean coping in the sense that we mean, let me cope with my problems, and you know, I'm like down on the floor and I'm coping. That's not the sense that I mean coping. Coping means getting out of our comfort zone in this respect. It means taking risks. It means daring. It means having high expectations and going for them. It means trying out for a play. It means approaching a person, even though I'm afraid. It means putting our hand up in class, in section. Coping in many ways is about courage. And courage is not about not having fear. Courage is about having fear and going ahead anyway. Again, accepting, embracing the fear, and then going ahead anyway. So this is what coping is. So what Bandura is saying is that people who cope, who try things out, who work hard, remember Edison, there is no substitute for hard work, who work hard, who try hard, ultimately achieve some success. And he says it could be a little bit of success. But remember, there are no miracles. You work hard, you'll do better. You study harder, you'll do better. You take more free throws, you'll do better. And they improve. And as a result of that success that comes from hard work, what Bandura has shown is that their self-efficacy, their belief in themselves, rises. And as a result of that self-efficacy going up, they work harder. They're prepared to take more risks. Because self-efficacy, according to the research by Bandura, not only makes us happier, it makes us more resilient,
it makes us more motivated. Remember the graph that I drew here with the motivation coming from high levels of beliefs. So we work harder, we succeed more, self-efficacy goes up, we work harder, we cope more, and so on and so on. There's also the reverse of this loop. What if I avoid the opposite of coping? Well, what happens if I avoid, if I don't and don't work hard, some of it because I don't want to put myself on the line and risk failure, then I'm less likely to succeed, my self-efficacy will not go up, and I may even enter a downward spiral. Because as I mentioned last time, learn to fail or fail to learn. Without failure, we will not strengthen our self-efficacy, we will not succeed more. It's almost like the immune system. You know, you have to be sick with something for the immune system to strengthen. Counterintuitive, but that's the way it works. Also on the psychological level, we need to cope, we need to fail in order to strengthen our psychological, internal immune system. And if we avoid, we don't do that. As I said, I think one of the biggest problems with Harvard students, and I'm including myself in it as a Harvard undergrad, because since then, as I will mention later on today, I failed many times, but we didn't fail enough. And we haven't gotten used to failing, and our immune system hasn't strengthened. So I'm not saying let's look for failure, but when failure does come, we can interpret it and say, okay, it hurts, it's terrible, I wish it didn't happen, but it has happened. Now let me embrace it and move on, and continue coping, continue working hard and going around the loop. So this is one way of increasing our self-efficacy, which I think is captured best by the theologian philosopher Kierkegaard, who said, to dare is to lose one's footing momentarily. Not to dare is to lose oneself. To lose one's footing momentarily, that's the temporary down that we experience, and then we go back up to our base level. To lose oneself is permanent. That's when we hurt our self-esteem. That's when we hurt our levels of happiness. That's when we risk going into a downward spiral. Very powerful quote. I want to talk to you now about the second approach to raising levels of belief, and that is through the imagination. There's something I want to tell you, but only if I have your guarantee that you're not going to tell it to anyone else. It's just between you and me. Okay? And I'll tell you after why it's just between you and me. You and I, you and me, you and me. I get really nervous standing in front of an audience, especially a large audience, which means more than three people. I really do. I'm not kidding. I get very nervous. It's something that I've had since the time I remember myself. I don't know what the first experience, you know, probably when I was three. But I'm afraid of large crowds. But, and I largely avoided large crowds until I was 21. And the times when I did speak in front of large crowds, I would be shaking. Very often I would start sweating. I would blush a lot. But at the age of 21, I decided that my mission in life, my purpose, was to be a teacher. I didn't know yet exactly in what form, but I knew that that is what I wanted to do. My personal mission statement was then, or became then, and still today, to make the world a better place through education. And I knew that if I was going to do that, I would have to stand in front of three people or more. So I started working on it. And I used a lot of things that I'd learned from Swash. So remember the secret of success, optimism, belief, passion, and hard work. So I had the passion. I knew that this is what I wanted to do more than anything else. I wanted to teach. I wanted to spread goodness. I had the passion for it. I had the hard work. I work extremely hard. I mean, I don't know if you have an idea how hard I work preparing for these lectures. The best advice I got about lecturing was from two people. One is Professor Richard Hackman, who said, when I asked him for advice about teaching, he said, what I do, and he's a phenomenal teacher. Those of you who have taken his class, if you haven't, you should. He says, prepare, 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 and then be spontaneous. It's great advice. Another good advice I got was from Mark Twain, who said that I usually take 3 weeks to prepare for extemporaneous speech. Again, phenomenal speaker, a lot of preparation. So I prepare a lot. So I have the hard work, I have the passion, but what I was missing was the belief in myself that I could do it. Now, the hard work certainly helped because I put myself out there and I coped. But another technique that I used that helped me a lot, one that I got from my squash playing days, was imagining myself successful. Seeing myself standing in front of an audience and actually delivering a talk. Delivering a talk and seeing myself calm, seeing myself having a good time. And I did that, and I still do it, every day for years. And I got this technique initially from athletics. It comes from Eastern thought. The Eastern Europeans, opposed to Asia, the Eastern Europeans, the athletes used it a lot. They would see themselves running around the track, winning the race, and then getting the gold medal. And many athletes, I'm sure some of you do it with your, does anyone do it here with your sports team? Where you visualize, in what sport? In rowing. You know, so you visualize yourself in, you know, perfect synchronicity with the others. In squash, we did it when I played it. It really is an effective technique, and it works. The question is, why does it work, and why does it work so well? The answer relies a lot on work done also here by Professor Stephen Coslin, the head of our department. And what Professor Coslin showed, and you have an article from Nature magazine, or Science magazine, one of the two, in this week's readings that talks about this. The mind works as a simulator. In other words, if I now look at my hand in front of me, and I have certain neurons in the visual cortex mostly, are firing as I look. Now, if I close my eyes and imagine that the hand is here, the exact same neurons will fire. In other words, the subconscious mind does not differentiate between the real thing and the imaginary thing. If I imagine success and over and over again consistently, and my mind, remember, doesn't like when there is incongruency between what is inside and what is outside. Remember the consistency argument? The mind wants them to be the same. So if I convince my mind and put the schema, the positive schema in my mind that I'm successful, and prove to it, because the mind doesn't differentiate between me giving a talk and me imagining giving the talk, if I do it enough, over time, the mind will look for consistency, just like Roger Bannister did, and I will perform as well as I imagine. Now, the important thing with imagination, and there has been a lot of good research done on it, is that we don't just focus on the destination. So I don't just focus on myself sitting here feeling comfortable and at ease. I also focus on the process of getting there. I focus on my working hard. I focus on my preparation, all in my mind. And it can happen in a minute. I mean, it doesn't have to take long, because images come at, you know, 100 miles an hour. It's important to focus on the journey as well as the destination. There was research done by Shelley Taylor, psychologist from UCLA. And what she did was she took a group of people, divided them randomly into two, and asked one group of students, these were students, to focus and imagine themselves getting an A on an exam. The second group of people had to imagine themselves working for the exam and then doing well on it.
So not just the destination, the journey and the destination. The group that focused on both, on the journey and the destination, did better on the exam than the other group. Now, why was it? Partially maybe because they were more motivated, but also because they didn't provide an illusion for the mind that, well, all you need to do is imagine and then it will happen. So focus on the destination as well as on the journey. Focus on the race as well as the finishing line. The best image of success that I've come across in terms of portraying this picture of a successful future is the Martin Luther King speech, "I Have a Dream." I don't know how many times I've read it, and I've studied it in depth, both for leadership purposes, but also for positive psychology purposes. And I want to share with you a few lines from it, where he focuses on both journey and destination. So here is a journey excerpt. "We must forever conduct our struggle on the high plane of dignity and discipline. We must not allow our creative protest to degenerate into physical violence. Again and again, we must rise to the majestic heights of meeting physical force with soul force." And beyond the beauty of it, he's talking about the journey. How are we going to get there? And then he tells us where the there is. And he says, and this is destination, "I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood." Another destination, "I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character." A vivid image of where this country will go to. And he planted this image of success in a generation and was able to effect change as a result of it. That's not the only thing he did effectively. The other important thing to remember when we do the image of success exercise is to involve different senses. Why? Because the more senses we involve when we imagine it, the more our mind will be convinced that this is the real thing. So hear it, feel it, taste it. You know, when I imagine myself standing in front of the audience, I hear the audience. I listen to my voice. I see the audience. Tactile, I actually feel, you know, holding this remote control. Make it as real as possible, which is what Martin Luther King did in his speech. Listen to his use, beautiful use of all the senses. Here is the visual. "Now is the time to make real the promise of democracy. Now is the time to rise from the dark and desolate valley of segregation to the sunlit path of racial injustice." Sorry, of racial justice. So, sorry. You can see it. I mean, you can see what racial justice, the light, the darkness, beautiful images. Here's another one of taste. "Let us not seek to satisfy our thirst for freedom by drinking from the cup of bitterness and hatred." How real is that? You can actually feel it on your tongue, the bitterness and the thirst and the water, the taste. Here's another one. No, we're not satisfied, and we will not be satisfied until justice rolls down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream. Mighty stream. I mean, you can feel the water, you know, hitting us, tactile. One more, auditory. "Let freedom ring from the snow-capped Rockies of Colorado. Let freedom ring from the curvaceous slopes of California." Again, you hear it. Make it as real as possible. Use all the senses. And finally, evoke emotions. Emotion leads to motion. You want to excite yourself. So when you think about this thing that you really, really want to do and you imagine it and you imagine yourself doing it, bring in emotion, whether it's excitement, even a little bit of fear and tension, that's okay. But have that be emotion because it makes it real. Emotion leads to emotion. Let me show you again, an excerpt, an example of emotion. Said, free at last, and God Almighty, free at last. Would even have the impact that he had saying what he said. Every time I listen to him, there are shivers. You know, the emotions that come in. There has to be emotion also in our imagining of success. Emotion leads to motion, whether it's in leadership, whether it's when we try and imagine success. Imagining success. All right. Didn't happen. Let me move on, because I needed therapy afterwards, to cognitive therapy. Cognitive therapy basically focuses on transformation as opposed to information. It focuses on changing the way our mind takes the information from the outside. And I'm going to introduce it now, I'm going to talk about it later today, and I'm going to talk about it for the rest of the semester, because it is a very powerful technique. But let me explain what it is, just very briefly, and I highly recommend you Google it and you read about it beyond. I'm actually thinking of teaching a whole class just based on the premises of cognitive therapy. I think it's so important. But here is just an introduction. The basic premise is that thoughts drive action. For example, I walk in the street and suddenly I see a lion. The thought that registers, dangerous. The emotion that I feel, fear. I walk in the street, I suddenly see a woman. The thought that registers, it's my wife. The emotion, love. I walk around the square, suddenly I see a note up there. The thought that registers, audition for a play. The emotion that I experience, fear or threat. Emotion, sorry. You have the event, you have the evaluation, and you have the emotion. This is how cognitive therapy, this is the basic premise of cognitive therapy, of how things work. And what cognitive therapy does then, it says that if we want to change our emotion, emotion, say, of unhappiness, depression, anxiety, what we need to do is not focus on the event, because the event very often has nothing to do, is independent of us. The way to change our emotion is to change our evaluation. In other words, our thinking. In other words, our cognition. That's where the intervention comes. And what it's about is restoring rational thinking. Because many of our thoughts that come as a result of an event are irrational and therefore lead to emotions that are unhealthy. Now, cognitive therapy, a therapist would never say, you know, let's say after I apply for a play and I don't make it, we'll never say don't feel sad. Sadness, natural, permission to be human. It's not about not being anxious before I go and ask someone out. That's natural. It's not about not feeling anxiety before speaking to 900 people. That's natural. It's also not about saying to someone, well, you have failed, Don't be upset about it. That's also natural. All these things are part of being human. But what it's saying is that the evaluation can be irrational. And from saying something like, I have failed on this exam, or I haven't done well, to saying, I can never do well. No matter what I do, I will never succeed. I can never stand in front of an audience and speak. And the emotion that comes out of this is deep levels of anxiety, unhappiness, or depression. So it's not about not feeling, but it's about a rational evaluation of the situation. And I'll give you some examples in a minute. Cognitive therapy has been shown to be the most effective intervention technique. Not yet, maybe it will in the future, the jury's still out on that, not for extreme levels of anxiety or extreme levels of depression. Again, the jury's still out on that. But cognitive therapy in and of itself has been shown to be the most effective in dealing with the most common form of depression, the most common form of anxiety. There's a lot of research out there on it. And the important thing, once again, it's an acquired skill. It's something that we can learn. I think that for me, the best book and the most accessible book on this topic, if you want to read further, is called I think the name is The Feeling Good Handbook. And it is written in a very self-help language, but it is based on scientific and rigorous study. It's written by David Burns. David Burns was actually a student of Aaron Beck, those of you who have taken classes in psychopathology, who is the father in many ways of cognitive therapy. He was also the teacher of Marty Seligman. And what David Burns talks about are the 10 cognitive distortions that are most common, that are irrational, and that lead to unnecessary negative emotions. And the reason I bring this up now is because optimists versus pessimists, you can distinguish between the two according to their evaluation of a situation. Very often the optimists are the rational ones, the pessimists are the irrational ones, and let me give you examples. And you have, this is in your reading list also, you can also Google it, you'll find a lot of information on these cognitive distortions. But just briefly, I'm going to talk about a couple now and a few more later on. All or nothing thinking. This is about thinking in absolutes. An almost perfect performance is no good. So for instance, if I almost get a perfect score in an exam, it's as good as a total failure. The rational approach would be, I didn't do as well as I hoped to on one exam. All or nothing. A similar one is overgeneralization. A single event is generalized to the future. Pessimists tend to overgeneralize. For example, let's say I ask, I'm a Harvard undergrad, I saw in 15 minutes there is research, there is an article on the Wellesley women. I'm a Wellesley woman, and I ask a Harvard undergrad out. And he says, no, I only date Harvard women. Now, there are a few ways to approach it. One is to say the irrational approach, there are no men to date. The rational approach would be, there are so many charming, intelligent, hot men in 1504. And the class is open, I can just come here. Another irrational cognitive distortion, mental filter. I have a project and I present a project, everyone loves it, but one person can't stand it, thinks it's awful, not good. The mental filter that leads to an irrational emotion is, my project wasn't able to inspire. Versus, just about everyone was excited by my project. And we very often tend to focus on the negative, and I'll talk about why we tend to focus on the negative later today. One thing, and we overgeneralize, all or nothing. disqualifying the positive. Pessimists tend to do that. Undervalue our accomplishments. For instance, I just don't seem to be able to succeed, versus focusing on the full part of the glass. I got into Harvard, I'm doing this extracurricular, I'm succeeding here. What do we focus on? Well, the pessimist tends to focus on the negative. Remember, it's all a question of interpretation. There's the objective, performance, but then ultimately it's determined by how much we believe. I'm not going to go over the others, I'll go over them later, but it's jumping to conclusions in terms of mind reading. He didn't look at me today, so it means he doesn't like me. Or fortune telling, I just know that I'm not going to do well. Magnifying or minimizing success or failure as opposed to being rational. Emotional reasoning, I feel envy, therefore I must be a bad person. Or I feel guilt, and therefore it must mean that I have done wrong. Also very often, sometimes rational, not always, sometimes it's warranted, but very often it's irrational. Should or must statements, this is a critical thing, especially for us here. Oh, I must get the paper in on time. Oh, I must study for the exam. There is no must here. You're here because you want to be here. You see, you can reframe your whole experience at Harvard with this simple thing. No one is for, you're over 18, and most of you are over 18. You have a choice. You don't have to be here. You chose to be at Harvard. And it changed, for me, this was important actually, because I always used to talk in must language. Oh, I must get this on time. Oh, I must prepare for this. Or I must stay up. Told to. No, I choose to. And the language over time makes a difference. It becomes subconscious when we talk, oh, I must get this paper. No, you, it's not. You'll pay the consequences if you don't, perhaps, but it's still a choice. And when we reconstruct, cognitively reconstruct our life and perceive it as a choice, it can make a lot of difference. Think about it next time you use the word, oh, I must get this done. No, I want to get this done. Why? Because I prefer getting a good grade here, but it's still a choice. Always a choice. The labeling, oh, I'm so stupid. And we say it, we don't even think about it. But remember how much priming has an influence on us, on our subconscious. Oh, I just can't get these things. I can never succeed. These things prime us and ultimately lead to negative emotions. And we'll talk about this more later. And finally, personalization and blame. You know, the pessimist very often takes blame, personalizes things. Sometimes it's warranted, other times it's not. Let me take an extreme example that actually happens a lot with abused women. It's my fault. What can I do? Why am I upsetting him? We see this very often. There's an event, abuse, evaluation. It's my fault. That's irrational. No, it's not your fault. Get out of the relationship. But that irrational emotion, evaluation, leads to a negative evaluation of oneself. Guilt, low self-esteem, unhappiness. Cognitive therapy is about rational thinking, about realistic thinking. Let me end this part of this particular lecture, we're going to go on to the next one, with a study. It's a study that looks at extremely happy people. Tip of the stem. This is what Seligman and Dinner did, two of the leading researchers and positive psychology. They gave out happiness questionnaires, and what they did was identify the 10% happiest people that were not the most successful necessarily, not the most anything other than the happiest. And they studied them, and they compared them to the less happy people. And here is what they found, which was fascinating to my mind. They found that both groups, the extremely happy, the tip of the stem, and the less happy, the lower quartile. Were similar in that they all experienced the same number of negative emotions. Doesn't make sense, does it? But here was the difference. They had the same number of bouts of negative emotions, but for the happiest people, it didn't last as long. They got over it much quicker on average. In other words, remember the immune system? It's not that they didn't get sick. They got sick just as often. But they were more resilient. They were able to bounce back. And why? This is the interesting finding. Because they had different cognitive interpretations of the event. The event happens. There is very little we can do about most events just happening. After it happens, there is a natural reaction to it, an emotion that comes with it. But how do we evaluate? Do I evaluate it as, I'm just no good, no one will ever want me again? Or do I evaluate it, well, this is just one person who didn't like my project, or this is just one person who said no to me. And then I have a more rational evaluation that leads to much quicker recovery. Again, they experience it. They give themselves the permission to be human, but then they bounce back because of different cognitive interpretations. Because the cognitive interpretation becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. You see, if I evaluate every failure as a tragedy, as the end of the world, and I experience very strong negative emotions as a result, then it will last for a long time. Much longer than if I say, okay, so I failed, it hurts, I hate it, I wish it didn't happen, it sucks, and I cry. And by the way, crying is a very important mechanism to release stress. One of the main reasons, not the only reason, but one of the main reasons, I had this conversation with one of you, one of the main reasons why babies seem happier is because they cry more. They don't hold it in. They have a negative emotion, they're upset, they let it out. And do they let it out? They scream or they cry? So again, I'm not advocating wearing our hearts on our sleeves and getting out of this class and starting to cry. But for me, one of the big breakthroughs that I will talk about later was when I did give myself the permission to cry. You know, I come from an Israeli culture. Macho men, soldier men don't cry. And then when I gave myself the permission to do it, permission to be human, I can't even tell you how that helped. What a release that was. What a relief. So yeah, allowing these emotions to go through us. And at the same time, having and saying, okay, so it's happening, so I'm upset now. And then moving on and coping and putting ourselves on the line and trying and continuing to live, to dare, and to lose oneself momentarily perhaps, but to continue. Because how we interpret will determine whether we spiral down and experience much more depression or whether we spiral up. The same event, happy people or unhappy people. The same negative emotions, but then what do we do with these negative emotions? Do we allow them and then move on? Or do we continue to think, well, I'm never gonna get out of it, no one is ever gonna want me, and so on. Interpretation styles, and we're gonna visit and revisit this. Any questions about this before I continue? Yes, Debbie. Yeah, the question is, do antidepressants help pessimistic people? I don't know much about psychopharmacology. The research out there that I have read is that, yes. I mean, they wouldn't be using them. Again, they're very scientifically, they're proven, otherwise they wouldn't use them. My suggestion is, if nothing else works, absolutely. to try. And this has always been my philosophy. And I know some people who are very close to me, who have used them and have benefited a great deal. And we're able to get back on track as a result of that. However, I also think that there are many other techniques and methods and approach that are underutilized in our culture. And one of the reasons why they're underutilized is because we seek a quick fix. And to change, and this is what I say throughout this class, to change an interpretation style takes a lot of time. It doesn't, you will not have changed your interpretation style as a result of this lecture. It just doesn't happen that way. It's thinking about it, it's going over it again and again. It's not a quick fix. And hence, it's less popular, especially given now with the HMOs and the fact that someone cannot go to for therapy for 6 months. It doesn't work that way anymore. So the main answer is I don't know enough about it. The short answer is it has helped many people. I'm certainly for it in certain cases, and I'm for trying things like cognitive therapy, things like coping and trying, putting ourselves on the line, things like accepting and saying, so I'm depressed. It's a good sign. It means I'm not a psychopath nor dead, right? And giving oneself the permission to be human. And one of the reasons why people don't give themselves the permission to be human, going back to something I spoke about, is because of the great deception. Everyone is smiling. Everyone is happy. Why am I the only one who's not? You're not the only one. I'm not the only one. I know it. That has these ups and downs. And that leads to more acceptance, more permission. Yes. Yeah. Good. Good. Thank you for bringing it up. There is actually a lot of research on that, which I forgot to mention, that shows that when you couple antidepressants or anti-anxiety medication with CBT, it's much more successful. And the reason is because it will last for much longer. Because when you get off the antidepressants, what has changed? Whereas if you actually learn a new interpretation style, something has changed. Thank you for bringing it up. Yeah, and there's a lot of studies on it. You know, you go to Psych Info, CBT, antidepressants, hundreds will come up. Any other questions? Yes, or comments? Yeah. Good. Good question. The question, tell me if I'm paraphrasing you correctly, is it innate? Are we born optimists or are we born pessimists? And the answer to that is, yes, there is an innate component that defines a range. Again, I've said it before, it defines a range. It doesn't mean we're not going to be optimists or we're not going to be, or we're born destined to be optimists or pessimists. We're given a range. And we can move along that range, and we have a choice to move along that range. Marty Seligman himself says that he is, he talks about himself as being naturally grumpy. But he is, and that's why he was so interested in interpretation style. He has worked on it over the years and improved. Naturally, my natural skill set, I wasn't born an optimist. You know, I mentioned it in the interview for FM. I wasn't born an optimist. And by the way, this is why I think I can teach this class, or I should teach this class. Because if I were born an optimist and everything came easy to me, then I didn't really try it on myself. But I have tried all these techniques, and they do work, but they take time. Now, does it mean that I can be, you know, have the optimism and the happy-go-lucky attitude that Nelson Mandela does, who was able to maintain optimism being 27 years in prison? Probably not. I probably don't have that innate facility. But he also worked on his optimism, and he also worked and has transformed himself over the years. Other questions or comments? All right. Let me move on. To the next lecture, which we're going to touch on the next couple of times. And this is a question of focus. What do we focus on? It's a direct continuation of the optimism versus pessimism argument. This, by the way, anyone recognize? Helen Keller and her teacher Sullivan. Who was a consummate optimist. So the question is, after years of research, Ed Diener, who's the leading researcher on subjective well-being, said, it appears that the way people perceive the world is much more important to happiness than objective circumstances. And we talked about this a lot. So what he's saying is that the emotions are determined by two things, by the external event, but also by our internal interpretation of the event. And this is what ultimately leads to emotion. We can't say that events don't matter. Events do matter. They influence us. The question then, though, is what do we do with our evaluation? And that is determined by what we focus on. And this is the focus of the next two lectures. Because what we see is that people who have seemingly all the positive events happening to them, again, they have wealthy, successful family, doing well in everything, never seem to fail, still experience negative emotions, are unhappy, are depressed. And we see people who have really had things going against them, very unlucky people, but experiencing very positive emotions and always happy. Part of it maybe is the innate facility, but a lot of it, most of it, is what they do with what happened to them, what they focus on, in other words. Ralph Waldo Emerson, to the different minds, the same world is a hell and a heaven. Along similar lines, Shakespeare, nothing is good or bad, but thinking makes it so. Now, I don't totally agree with Shakespeare, and I'll elaborate on more later why, but to a great extent, he's right. It's usually our evaluation, our thinking, our cognition that makes something good or bad. Let's do an exercise. Just the lights down. Harvard students, I know that there are not many of you are math concentrators, but still, I'm going to give you a math problem. How many geometric shapes do you see in the following slide? How many geometric shapes do you see in the following slide? Actually, do it. When you have the number, please write it down. Five more seconds. All right. Lights. Anyone want to venture a guess or a guesstimate or a precise response? How many geometric shapes were there?
Nine.
Sorry? 50? 50? Others? 100, 1,000,000, 7,000, 7,200,000,000, yeah. Yeah, others, 25, 36 you had, 3, 9, 8, 20. What was that? Okay. Now, for those of you who have the PowerPoints who downloaded it, don't look at the picture now. How many children were there on the bus? Don't say it if you know, but write it down if you know. Don't look at the PowerPoints if you have them. How many children were there on the bus? How many people know? Put your hands up.
Two.
out of 900. It's pretty good. What time did the clock say? What time did the clock say? How many people know? Just put your hands up. One, two, three, four, five. That's better. Wow, 5 out of 900. Well, there were 5 children on the bus, and the clock said 10 after 10. That was easy. That was the easier question. I mean, geometric shape, that's a hard question, because you have, is this a geometric shape? Is the whole thing a geometric shape? Are these little things here geometric shape? That's a hard, but I asked you an easy question and you didn't know? Harvard students? Well, this is a psychology class, I understand. But this was at me, not at you. I mean, why? What happened here? What happened here? What happened? Yeah. You focused on counting, and what you focus in on becomes your reality. What we focus on becomes our reality. In the words of Stavros and Taurus, we see what we look for, and we miss much of what we are not looking for, even though it is there. Our experience of the world is heavily influenced by where we place our attention. Do we focus on the positive things in our life? Do we focus on the negative? That very often determines what our lives will look like. There are two archetypes, and these archetypes, no one fits perfectly into one archetype or the other. They basically define a continuum. And these two archetypes, one which is the merit finder, one which is the fault finder, which I will elaborate on in a minute, determine or capture what it is that we focus on, what it is that we choose to focus on in our lives, the great things in our lives or the negative things in our lives. Because every life has amazing things in it. Every life has bad things in it. What do we focus on? Because what we focus on very often becomes our reality, becomes our experience. The fault finder. The fault finder is the person, and again, I'm defining the extreme of the continuum. The fault finder is a person who makes lemon out of lemonade. Always seeking the negative. I got this term from Thoreau. The fault finder will find faults even in paradise. The problem with the fault finder archetype, or people who are closer to that part of the continuum, is that it often leads to resignation. Why? Because if we only focus on part of reality, and that's the negative part, after a while, we actually begin to believe that reality is negative. We don't think about the fact that reality is actually mirroring my evaluation. We actually begin to believe that reality is negative, and then we resign. Then, in the words of Marty Seligman, we experience learned helplessness. Because wherever I look, and you'll read about learned helplessness in my book, wherever I look, there's negative. Wherever I look, there is misery and suffering and pain. And I'm just resigned to this terrible world. In contrast, we have the merit finder, defining the other side of the continuum. The merit finder makes lemonade out of lemon. The merit finder finds the silver lining in the cloud. The merit finder looks at the bright side of life. The merit finder does not fault a lecturer for using too many cliches. One of the consummate merit finders, my role model in many ways, Ralph Waldo Emerson, the invariable mark of wisdom is to see the miraculous in the common. And both Emerson and Thoreau were able to walk out next to Walden Pond and just see the miraculous, look up in the sky and see the miracle. The There's a problem, though, with extreme ERIC finding in that it could lead to detachment, Pollyannish, detached, everything, happy-go-lucky. And the important thing to remember, in the words of Nathaniel Brandon, we need to respect reality. It's about understanding that there are negative events. It's about experiencing negative emotions, but at the same time, it's about recognizing that there is much more good than bad in the world. And it's about focusing our attention on it so that we can strengthen it and perpetuate it. Let me read to you an excerpt, beautiful excerpt from William James, who talks about how we co-create our reality. Remember, you created a certain reality when you focused on the geometric shapes instead of on the children. What we focus on becomes our reality. William James. Now, however fixed these elements of reality may be, the events, we still have a certain freedom in our dealing with them. Take our sensation. That they are is undoubtedly beyond our control, but which we attend to, note, and make emphatic in our conclusions depends on our own interests, and according as we lay the emphasis here or there, quite different formulations of truth result. We read the same facts differently. Waterloo, with the same fixed details, spells a victory for an Englishman, for a Frenchman, it spells a defeat. So, for an optimist philosopher, the universe spells victory. For a pessimist, defeat. What we say about reality thus depends on the perspective into which we throw it. In other words, what we focus on makes all the difference. Another beautiful poem by James Sutton. Isn't it strange how princes and kings and clowns that caper in sawdust rings and common people like you and me are builders for eternity? Each is given a list of rules, a shapeless mass, a bag of tools, and each must fashion, ere life is flown, a stumbling block or a stepping stone. A fault finder will find a stumbling stone. A merit finder, a stepping stone. Going back to the question of interpretation. How we interpret reality makes all the difference. Ann Harbison, who was a graduate student here, now works for Gallup, reconstructs failures. And she says, never let a good crisis go to waste. We learn a lot. She learns to see it as a stepping stone as opposed to a stumbling block. And it takes a lot of training. Interpretation styles don't change in a lecture. Something we need to be conscious of, and you're going to write about this, by the way. Your next response paper is going to be turning a stumbling block to a stepping stone, which you're going to get later tonight. I want to share with you an experience that I had here, which was, for me, was an eye-opening experience. So I was a resident tutor, as many of you know, in Leverett House for 6 years. I was the psychology tutor, the philosophy tutor, and also the business, the pre-business tutor. And I think it was 2001. We had a pre-business meeting with the seniors going through recruiting or otherwise. And 2001 was not a good year. The market, maybe it was 2002, one of them. It was a bad year. The market was down. No longer did the consulting companies come to Harvard, you know, and hand you a contract on a silver platter, you know, with luscious signing bonuses. And it's still, by the way, not the case as it used to be before. I remember back in 1999, for example, it was unbelievable. So the market wasn't good at the time. Credit Suisse, First Boston, had just laid off thousands of employees. Needless to say, they were not going to recruit. Morgan Stanley or Stanley Morgan or Goldman Sachs, one of the two, laid off thousands of employees that year. The National Bank of Germany was laying off tens of thousands of employees, and that affected, of course, the recruiting here and the economy. Things were not good, certainly not as good as last year. And as a pre-business tutors, there were a few of us, we felt the need to tell our students that. And then after we were telling them how bad the market is, one of the students put his hand up. He was one of my students, and his name was Shane. And he said to me, you know, knowing that I'm really into positive psychology and stuff, he said, okay, so you've told us about all the terrible things in the market and how hard it's going to be to find a job this year. Is there anything optimistic, anything good you can tell us? And, you know, I smiled at him, and I thought about it, and my initial impulse, again, having been trained as a, not having been born as an optimist, but having been trained as an optimist, my initial impulse was to say, things happen for the good, things happen for the best. And you know this cliche, right? That was my initial impulse, but upon reflection, I thought, I actually don't believe that. I don't believe this. I don't believe things happen for the best, necessarily. And I thought about it for many days, and I spoke with Shane about it, and we discussed it. And then I came up with a formulation that I think, it is what I believe, and I think it captures reality better than things happen for the best. And the formulation is, things don't necessarily happen for the best, but some people are able to make the best of things that happen. Big difference. You see, because when things happen for the best, it's a passive approach. It's optimism, sure, but it's optimism based on blind faith, which in the long run doesn't lead to happiness. And again, I'm not connecting here to belief in God or not. I'm talking about our successes, because one sentence that I grew up with a lot, you know, with my 24/7 Marvel Collins, and I grew up in a religious home, is that God helps those who help themselves. Right? I'm sure many of you have heard this before. So I'm not talking about the religious faith here. I'm talking about, well, the market is bad. It happened for the best. Or I just didn't make it into a play that I wanted to. It happened for the best. No, it doesn't necessarily happen for the best. It sucks. It hurts. But there are some people who are able to make the best out of things that happen. And this is optimism that's not based on blind faith. It's based on hard work. It's based on hard work. And this is optimism that's connected to reality. And let me end with a quote by one of the consummate optimists who, with his optimism, I would argue, saved the free world. And this is a person you don't want to argue with, so you better listen carefully. A pessimist sees difficulty in every opportunity. An optimist sees the opportunity in every difficulty. Difficulties often suck. They're difficult. They're hard. They're painful. 1 minute, 1 minute, less than a minute. But if we're able to take these difficulties, these stumbling blocks, and reinterpret them, cognitively reconstruct them into opportunities, then that can make all the difference. Have a wonderful weekend. See you next week.